Hello and welcome to another episode of Control Alt Access. You know the drill at this point. We talk about video game accessibility. I'm one of your hosts, Laura, and I'm here as ever with my lovely co-host, Arevia. How are you doing today?
I am doing well. I have just watched through all of the GAConf. I couldn't mostly not get them live this year, so but now I'm up to date, so I'm happy.
You've just finished flooding your brain with 2 days worth of accessibility information, as we do every year.
Yes.
We're not in person this year. GAConf Europe has done all of their talks digitally and remotely this year, so you're not seeing us on that one sofa that you usually get us once a year on. But we're still here. We've watched all the talks. We're going to give you the rundown on what we think of all the talks that happened this year, so that if you don't, like us, have the time to watch 2 full days worth of talks, you can maybe jump into some of the most interesting ones.
Yes.
Also, it helps that this year they've already uploaded all of the talks as individual video uploads, so you can just jump straight to the link for the one that sounds interesting to you, rather than having to scrub through the 2 day live stream. So that's very good.
That was what I did today, so I highly recommend everybody else do it as well. It's in a nice timelined, what do you call it? Like a
nice and organized.
Yeah, what is it called on YouTube? We have like videos.
Oh, playlist.
Playlist. There we go. Yes. Brain nice fried and already.
Yeah. That's alright, we got that. But yeah, should we start chronologically with, I guess the first one is The Art of Caring.
Yes.
Which is a talk by Clement Strasser about the game The Art of Fauna. We've talked a little bit about this game before. It is a game that is about, like, making pictures of animals from nature, like basic puzzles, but it can be played by sightless blind players because the back of each puzzle piece is words about the animal, and you can use text-to-speech to put the words together to make the puzzles.
Yep.
And this was a talk about, like, the accessibility thoughts that went into making that game.
Yeah, I really, really enjoyed this talk. This is one of the highlights for me from the whole GAConf. I really, really loved his like focus on that when you care, you actually get back. Like, you actually get things back. He talked a bit about how people were annoyed that this game cost money, but when he explained why and how he used the money, people were often quite like, they were willing to delete their one-star review because they now had an understanding for why this game isn't free, like mobile games often are.
Yeah. Yeah, because the way with this game is that you have, I believe, 10% of the puzzles. So the first tenth of the game you can play for free. And then it's like, hey, I'm a single person that made this thing and I do kind of need to eat. So, like, get to give me a couple of quid.
Yeah. And I think one of the things I really loved was that all the pictures in the game are taken from old school, these like old school biology books.
Yeah.
And to sort of pay a bit back to the homage that he had gotten all his stuff for free and not used AI, which is the most important. He did not use AI. He ended up then actually giving back by giving back to foundations that take care of nature, different nature and stuff in the, around the world. So he has like bought land, not him, but an organization is funded, have bought land in the Alps to make sure that this will not be built on, this will not be done anything to, so it's conserved the nature life there.
There's a couple of really nice things in this talk I wanted to point out. He opens the talk by sharing a little anecdote about one of the interactions he had that made him realize that the accessibility work he'd done was important, where someone who worked at Apple recognized him and walked up and I think wrote a message on their phone just saying, like, hey, thank you so much for the accessibility work that you do, and gave them a little accessibility pin and walked off, and that was very sweet.
Yes.
But I also really like the way that he talks in this talk about how he, at this point in his career, won't make a game unless the idea is both fun and has accessibility potential.
Yeah.
And he talks about, like, he had the idea for Art of Fauna and couldn't work out how to make it accessible, put it on the back burner, and it was going on a nature walk and seeing one of those boards that has both a picture of the animals that you might see in the area and then some text about those animals that made him go, oh, that's how I can make it accessible. Went back and was like, now I'll make the game. Now that I've worked out, like, a way to make it accessible. And I really like that way of thinking of just because an idea can't be accessible doesn't mean you won't, something in life won't make you have that moment of, that's how I make it accessible, I can do it now.
Yeah. I think this is such a unique way of accessibility through design. And I absolutely love it. I think it's so cool. And it's also cool for, on the opposite way of somebody who has dyslexia, struggling a lot with text, but I could get it read out for me, then it would make more sense in my head and also then have the pictures. So the other way is also accessible, and I absolutely love it.
Indeed. The next talk is Your Controls Suck, probably, by Carrie Waterton, who we know Carrie. Carrie's lovely. This is a talk that is sort of aimed at making accessible video game controls is about more than just offering button remapping. And that's not to say button remapping isn't useful, but, like, trying to get developers to have, like, a bit more of a big picture look of the other things that, like, good controls kind of mean in an accessible context.
Yes, and also I sort of want to sum it down to, like, motor accessibility often just is KISS, keep it simple, stupid, in the form of, like, if you can and have the ability to simplify your controllers, it would just automatically be more accessible. Because if you overcomplicate things, you just make barriers for everyone there.
A big part of this talk was, like, when you start out designing games, you are going to make really complicated control schemes, and just look at your control schemes and go, can I reduce this down? There was an example given of Atomfall, where it's like, there's a single button on the keyboard that does five different things depending on context.
Yeah.
And rather than making those five things five different buttons, it's like, well, you're never going to be doing these things at the same time, so this one button, dependent on context, can swap what it does. And, like, things like that that you can do to minimize your controls, be it stuff like, can you think about ways to make a one-handed control schemes possible, and, like, the ways that that forces you to really think about simplifying what your actually important controls are.
Yeah, and also, this is also quite normal already. Like, we already have things like interact buttons. Like, we also have a button that is just an interact button. Interact with something. But that can also be interact as in talk to somebody, interact as opening a door, interact as giving someone something. So this concept already lives here. We can just pull it even further with the help of accessibility. And I also, one thing that I could not, like, shake off myself when I was watching this or listening to this talk was the fact that a lot of times when a game or a console comes out with a new concept, so like the PlayStation 5 came out with a touchpad, every single game they came out with had to use the touchpad. It was just sort of like forced upon you, even when you couldn't use the touchpad because the touchpad in itself was quite inaccessible. And I am surprised that Nintendo, that now came out with a Switch 2 and have their mouse thingamajiggy, do not force it more on us. And I was just like, what is this? Nintendo being the good guy. Again, it still surprises me when they do that. But they have actually now come out with a cool feature and understood that we can't just force it on people just because.
Yeah. I think the wheelchair basketball game, I forget the name of, is the only game I can think of that Nintendo have published themselves that makes it mandatory to use the mouse mode.
Yeah.
All of their other games have been like, it's entirely optional, it's here if you benefit from it.
Yeah.
And, like, generally speaking, I think that is a lot more restraint than we normally see from Nintendo on that front.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. But yeah, I think that this talk is really good in terms of, like, it lays out, and this is something Carrie's always really good at with GA Conf talks, is really good practical steps developers can take away. Like, this talk lays out, like, here is, like, the common things you should be thinking about with controls. Here is the process of, like, work out whether these barriers in your particular game are for, like, mandatory areas, side areas, optional areas. Like, use that to determine how big of a barrier it is. Who does it help? What is the cost versus benefit analysis there? Things that you can use to sell this to your higher-ups, like, would implementing this help us to get accessibility tags? And, like, it really walks through all of the steps of, here's how you make sure that, like, it's not going to be a problem for your production pipeline.
Yeah.
Here's how you really integrate this into a development environment, and I think that's so valuable.
And Life Below got mentioned, which makes me really happy.
I was so happy. I have it here in my notes being like, that game that a review's been giving advice on was a good example of a game doing it right. Look at that.
But I have to say, though, this is actually the developers themselves that came up with this, and it wasn't me who did this. But it is really, really cool that Life Below will be completely possible to play with just your mouse navigation and one click. That's it. Everything in this game you can do with one.
Life Below's doing really cool stuff. I'm a big fan of what they're up to.
Oh, I can't wait. I can't wait. But yeah, next talk then. So, one of the more controversial talks of the EAConf.
Yes, and this was a panel. It's called Not Just Vibes: How Blind Players Are Modding Accessibility into Games with AI.
And I was
interested in this talk until it happened.
Yes. And I want to start with just, like, say what the talk wanted to be, and then I want to say what I wish this talk was.
Because
this talk was a talk that is... It is a talk that needs to happen in this space where the reason for AI and doing vibe coding, and if people listening to this wonder what vibe coding is sort of like you ask a AI bot to code something for it and they code it for you. You don't write the code yourself. You get a program to
when
write
people say
for
vibe
it.
Coding, they do not mean they're doing any coding themselves. They mean they are asking generative AI to make code for them.
Yes. Yeah. And what vibe coding has done the last couple of years is that it's opened many, many doors for games that are not accessible for blind players to now be accessible for blind players by using AI to help you understand what is happening on screen and make tools that can now be used by screen readers and used by AI, used by blind gamers, I mean. It helps with old and quote-unquote lost games for accessibility, sort of like games we will never see will be updated, so say Final Fantasy 1 through 6, but also ongoing games like RimWorld, which is still being updated to this day. So that is what they talked about, and that is what I want to start with.
There's a version of this talk that I think could have been really interesting, which, you know, in my head, what I was kind of coming into this expecting was something along the lines of, let's talk about the fact that many coding tools that currently exist are inaccessible for blind people. Let's talk about the barriers that exist in terms of blind people getting into traditional coding. Then talking about, like, look, there are problems with AI, we acknowledge that, but given the barriers that exist in coding for blind people, this feels like a necessary, like, the best option available to us, regardless of any problems it has, and here is what it's helping us to do.
Yeah.
Instead, it felt like a really uncritical... It felt like a very uncritical discussion that does not acknowledge any of the problems with AI, and simply... It felt like an advertising sales pitch for AI is so much faster, you don't have to do any of the work, the results are so much quicker. And I'm like, well, yeah, that's because you don't have to do any of the work. It's a machine that regurgitates other people's work for you. A thing that was never really acknowledged. It was just like, but you get answers so quickly with AI. It does the work for you. Without AI, I'd have had to work for multiple hours on this project, but I just type a thing in and it gives me it now. I'm like, It felt like the kind of talk I have heard from a lot of people who don't have access barriers, who just kind of sometimes there's a class of people that just enjoy that AI does the work for you. And there are times where this talk kind of felt that way.
Yeah, and I think where I want to like say that I think it's a bit not what I wanted to see is that AI has taken so many hundreds of thousands of jobs in this industry the last 4 years. And then having a panel about it, I think it does us a disservice not to talk about it and not to talk about the downside. In an hour panel, you should have been able to say the words that are like, and when Cyclist Combat tried to do, because he did. Yeah. He tried to get people to talk about it.
I respect the effort he was making to try and steer that panel.
But then the comment was, yes, AI is a divisive topic. Let's leave it at that. And that, I think, is a disservice as also for conference like GAConf. Yeah. I think it is a disservice because we need to be able to talk about these things. Yeah. And I also write in their Discord, I said, like, I'm also curious to see if we, due to AI, we will get a shift in accessibility being a quote-unquote company problem to fix, as it is today, to be a quote-unquote disabled gamers problem to fix, as in companies will reduce the accessibility in game because, quote-unquote, AI can make people fix it themselves. This is what used to be in, this is how it used to be in early game history. In like 70s, companies didn't offer accessibility. It was just like, well, if you need another tool, fix it yourself.
Yeah. And like, I want to say I'm really glad that like the particular mods that they were talking about in this talk that were made this way, I think are really valuable. I'm really glad they exist. I'm glad that like more blind players are able to play things like Hades too. I think that that mod existing is great. But I can also think that this talk really heavily skewed its data to fit a pro AI perspective. Other than Sightless Combat, the people that you know, were on the panel, were all people who had a very clearly pro-AI bias going in. And, like, the one example I want to give that I think, like, really points out how they were skewing the way they talked about things was in the talk, they made a statement, and this isn't going to be word for word, but this is basically what was said. The Slay the Spire blind accessibility mod was made without AI and took approximately 1 year to make. The Slay the Spire 2 mod was available in just 4 days. Now, that is not strictly true, because I was talking to them in the Discord. Well, the Slay the Spire 1 mod that was made without AI took a year to be the finalized 1.0 polished, stable version. There was a version of it available in only 2 months. So we've already got it down to 2 months without AI versus 4 days with AI. But also, that 4 days with AI was only able to be as short as it was because they fed in all the code from the made without AI Slay the Spire 1 mod and used AI to convert it to a different engine language. Like, it's not as simple as saying, oh, 1 year without AI versus 4 days with AI. It's like, no, it's 2 months versus 4 days, and that 4 days was only really achievable because someone did the 2 months without AI first. It's that kind of, like, stripping of nuance and complexity to favour the idea that we should be, to make it sound like AI is this magic tool that just does this out of nowhere, and we don't need people doing it without AI. It's like, no, you kind of needed the person doing it without AI to feed to the AI in the first place. The lack of nuance in the discussion of AI was frustrating, even in a situation where I can recognise it is great that 4 days after Slay the Spire 2 came out, blind gamers were able to play it, and it would be great to live in a world where more frequently that sort of speedy access to games was available to blind players, and I cannot ignore the fact that AI was part of what helped that be possible, but you gotta talk about both sides of it, I feel like.
I feel like this is a bit on GAConf as a conference as well. I feel like when you take such a controversial topic that has negatively affected our community in general, like the whole gaming industry, so much. Yeah. I wish that they would then have this talk. I don't have anything against this talk existing, but I also don't think then we should have on, we need them maybe a bit more, the hard facts on the other side, because this was a panel, and the panels are a lot about emotions and fun and these, like, how we experience things. There is space to have the more numbers talk on the other side, and that we can get a proper balance of something like this.
I feel like what this talk really could have benefited from is there. I've spoken to blind game developers before who have developed games entirely from scratch while blind. I feel like this panel could have really benefited from having a blind game developer on it to be a perspective of, like, let's be clear. It is possible for a blind person to code a thing themselves without using AI, and this talk did sort of almost present it as, well, we don't have to wrestle with the complicated aspects of AI because, like, well, there's no other way we could have done it. It's like, well, yeah, there are people who do it without AI. That feels like it could have been some nuance that could have benefited that talk.
Yeah.
It's a complicated one, that one. Then we go into the micro talks for day one. I think this first one we can get through really quickly. Why would anyone make an unplayable game?
It's a really, really fun talk.
It's a very fun talk by the creator of, quote, an unplayable game. We've talked about this before. It is a game that simulates what it is like to be a person who needs accessibility settings trying to play a fundamentally unplayable game, and teach you that, like, it's not about making the game easy, it's about making it technically completable. Part of me says, if you've not played that game, this micro talk at 15 minutes is about the same length as the game. Go play the game.
Go play the game.
Go watch the talk.
Yeah.
They're about the same length, and I think playing the game will get the point across to you. But I did like that they noted that the game Rollick and Roll from last year's AA Showcase got a speed adjustment setting based on the devs playing an unplayable game, and I think that's great.
The only thing I wrote in my notes were, welcome to my world, mwahaha! So, yeah, I think it is a good, like, what do we call it? I think they call it, like, sensitivity training when you're, like, forced to be set into a world. I'm not that big of a fan of it. Normally, like, when company does it, I am not normally that big fan of sensitivity training because I'm a bit, like, it can also do the wrong, showcase, like, the wrong things. But in this case, this is made so well. And it's also, It jokes around it. It is so well made around how they have executed it. So I think this is really, really, really well done.
Agreed. The next micro talk was Diaries of a Trophy Hunter, The Good, Bad, and the Ugly of Achievement Design. This was a talk given by Cameron Keywood. Really interesting talk about, like, the history of achievements in games. Talking about, like, best practices to do or to avoid, like, not locking achievements behind, like, difficulty modes or not turning them off if you have accessibility tools on, for example. Things like pointing out that FIFA has an achievement that you have to buy the premium season pack to get. And, just to look at, like, good and bad practices in achievement design, which is an area of accessibility I don't see talked about a lot.
Yeah, and it is, like, what I just wrote is a good talk on how to make good trophy hunting, and that includes being accessible. It's the same thing we always say. It's sort of like, when you just make good design, that automatically has to include to be accessible, because to be human is to be different. So therefore, to design for something that is different, you need to be accessible. And, like, it just comes back to good design practices, technically.
Yeah, agreed. Then we have Access Denied, the Illusion of Inclusion by Mikey Stratovoitov.
Yeah, this one was fun.
This is a really good, very important talk about accessibility for game developers in the workplace.
Yeah.
Talks about things like work from home, be fully remote, being, like, a really important thing for, you know, a bunch of different reasons. There was a story shared early on I thought was good that was about, Mikey shared an example of, he was working in an office and they introduced air conditioning and that started to exacerbate a medical issue for him. And his doctor recommended, hey, you should be working from home. And the boss says, if I let you work from home, I'll have to let everyone. No, you won't. Not everyone has a recommendation from their doctor saying they should.
Yep.
But, like, that led to, like, his bosses telling him, oh, you'll be unhireable if you disclose your disability. Like, they're trying to be like, well, you'll never get a job anywhere else being open about being disabled. You'll have to continue coming here even though it's making you ill. Like, the weird traps that people do to try and, like, force disabled people to do things that are not good for their health.
Yeah. And it reminds me of a story I also have. I got hired to be accessibility inclusion for a small company. And like, that was my job, accessibility inclusion. And we were going to an event and I got placed on a hotel 1.5 hours away from the event, a 2-day conference. Things like that. Like, that is the typical. And also I had a hotel at the area, but they were like, that's too expensive, you have to do this other hotel. And things like that. Like, this is not something unique. I think everybody I know that has worked in industry with accessibility have experienced that when they themselves ask for accessibility, they get denied it. And we need to talk more about this, because shame. We need to shame these people. They need to be heard and shamed. And also, I just, because I remember Scope had been talking about this, so I looked up some numbers and I said that in the UK, getting 5% of the over 25 workless due to sickness and disability back into work would save the country £11.9 billion. So, like, getting an inclusive workplace should be something that is on everybody's wish list. Like, every single person out there should want to do that, because it is an economic incentive for literally the whole of society to do this. And we know from, like, numbers that most people who are on disability benefits aren't there just because they're disabled. They're also there because they are forced to leave the workplace because of inaccessibility. And many people on disability benefit would not be on disability benefits if they actually had accessible workplaces. And that's an annoying thing as well, because, like, then every single week we hear on the news, oh, people on disability benefits is way too many. Then make workforce accessible and we would be back out doing our work.
Yeah.
And then the people who actually need to be on disability benefit could be on disability benefit and nobody would talk about it. Just, yeah, like, make workforce accessible. It's just, lady hitting at the sky.
I think one of my favorite things in this talk was pointing out hybrid working is not an accessibility accommodation.
Yes.
If someone needs to work from home remotely and they can do that, like, their job can technically be done from home remotely, it's not a reasonable compromise to go, okay, we'll only do that some of the days and then come into the workplace that's going to make you, like, physically ill or, like, is going to be bad for your disability. Do that a few days a week. You can have a few days a week where we accommodate you and then, like, some days where you agree not to be accommodated for your disability. No, if someone needs that accommodation, they need the accommodation. It's not fair to go, you can have the thing your disability needs. Fair compromise is some days you can be disabled and other days you'll have to push it away.
Yeah, Laura, can't you please just be disabled when it's convenient for me and my time schedule? Please?
Yeah, can you agree to only be disabled 2 days a week and the other 3 days a week you can, like, turn it off.
Just no problem. Disabled it. It's in the word.
Yeah.
No problem.
The next talk we had was a really interesting one.
Yes.
If you're interested in, like, the history of accessibility. The talk was called Ken Yankelevitz, a Pioneer in Accessible Gaming. This was a talk by Marcus Spora, a person who does university, like, historical research on the field of video game accessibility, which is very poorly documented because people were not keeping good documentation in the early days of our industry. But basically talking about this man who got his start making, like, he was a flight engineer who made video game controllers in his spare time. Atari reached out to him and were like, hey, There's this disabled kid who was, like, disabled in an accident and wants to be able to keep playing games. You make controllers. Can you make him a controller? He tried to make Atari, like, a mass-produced prototype that they could, like, make hundreds of to be available for people, and Atari were like, no, that'd be expensive, but, like, can we just, like, keep sending people to you every time, like, a disabled person comes to us? Can we just, like, send them to you and you can make them a controller?
Yeah.
Which is frustrating.
But it was quite interesting to see that, like, the Vita controller I use today, that technology, he pioneered that in 1981. Oh, yeah. Before I was even born, he pioneered it.
Yeah, a bunch of styles of accessibility controller that we have today definitely have their design roots in Ken's work.
Yeah.
Like, he pioneered a bunch of, like, the idea of sip and puff style controllers in a video game context. He was doing a lot of stuff with, like, dismantling existing controllers and, like, trying to take other existing accessibility tech and wire it to controllers. But, like, he, you know, foot controllers, simplified one-handed controllers, integrating button switches to have the inputs, like, wired to other places that were easy to reach. So much of that early work is just him doing stuff in his garage.
Yeah. And he ended up crafting over 700 controller individualized before he stopped doing it due to Parkinson. So,
And then it talks about sort of the follow-up to his work that ends up becoming the quad stick, which is still around today. This is a person who was really instrumental to the idea of accessible controllers, and I'm really glad there's, like, a good bit of documentation about, like, the history of his contribution to the industry.
Yeah, his name should be shouted out loud. And also, this talk was a genius talk of how game accessibility history and game history is the same. They, like, as long as we have had game history, we have had game accessibility history, and I'm so glad to just have yet another talk in my arsenal of going, like, hey, this is nothing new. This is not a modern concept.
Accessibility wasn't invented in 2020 when The Last of Us 2 came out. Like,
yes.
Some of it's predated that.
Yes.
Then we had a couple of last ones at the end of day one. We had accessibility as business strategy. This is from Anna Weismayer, who is Senior Product Inclusion Manager at Xbox, and Xander Ashwell, who is Director of Accessibility and User Experience at Rare. We can skim through this one. There's a lot of good data in here, but it's stuff like 3.6 billion people out of 8.1 billion on the planet are gamers. 6 billion are internet users. That means that, like, one third of the planet, roughly, are gamers. Another third is very much on the table. Then looking at, like, well, you know, looking at the US alone, 33.3 million of those are adults who play video games but have disabilities. Nothing in here that I think is very new to us as people that, like, people that, those of us that follow accessibility as a space, nothing in here was particularly new to learn. But it is a good primer if you just want to, like, soak up some of the basic numbers and things, I think.
Yeah, and I have some, my three quotes that I really enjoyed from the talk. Not quotes, but, like, takes.
Yeah.
Like, 16% of hard of gamers in the US are hard of hearing, but some games have up to 97% of gamers using subtitles. In the form of, like, these are numbers that is really easy to correlate how accessibility is used by a plethora of more people than just disabled players.
Mm-hmm.
And also nearly half the players of Call of Duty access the accessibility menu in their game, which I think is really, really cool. And also how Sea of Thieves is a great example of, like, when you start accessibility work, it does not need to be perfect. You can actually continue doing it. And we have been saying since we started this podcast, the best way to start accessibility work was yesterday, and the second best day is today. And that just sums up the talk from Xander. And also he said, your audience is likely more diverse than your dev team, so talk to other people. I think that was brilliant, because you don't need to sit on all the answers yourself. You actually can talk to other people. and get a lot of answers given to you by people who has already figured this out from before.
And then the last one we had of day one was Spectrum Gaming, an autistic-led UK charity creating joyful and safe spaces through gaming.
Yes.
This is Sari Ashwell talking about Spectrum Gaming, which is a charity that basically offers in-person, but also online, safe social spaces, advocacy and training for autistic children. Some basic facts, 80% of the staff working at this charity are autistic. That's great. They have a bunch of stuff where they're basically like, to make sure that these autistic children are safe in the spaces they're creating, there is like, there's an interview process and stuff that initially happens. There is a little bit of gatekeeping involved to make sure that the people who are accessing these services are the people who need to be. But in response, they have like a bunch of like curated Minecraft worlds that they have like moderators 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. Monday to Friday to sort out any like disputes or anything that to keep things nice and moderated in those communities. Making a space where just autistic people can autistic children can safely socialize with other autistic children in a space where there are adults to make sure that that is safe and well facilitated.
Yeah, and I think that, like you said, most of them are autistic themselves, or autistic-led, which I think is really important. Because I always get afraid when I, especially about charities about autism, I always get afraid because I am afraid it's yet one of those charities where people without a problem tells us who face a problem how we should handle it. That is not how it should be. You should listen to the people who actually experience things. So this charity does that, and I'm so glad for that. But this is also yet one of the reasons, and I talked a bit about it in the Discord, why I really, really hate the things that are starting in EU now, where we age limit gaming and social media with actually not only, like, Discord has rules of stuff, I'm not talking about that, but actually people having to identify verification themselves to access internet. That is horrible. And I want to just point out that when you do that, you take away access for the most vulnerable people of your society, and you take away privacy for grown-up humans that should be able to decide themselves what they do with their own time. And I'm so pissed because Norway is now trying to get it through as well. And it seems like a lot of people is just voting yes because like, oh, but think about the children. Oh, clutch my pearls. And oh my God. And not thinking the actual consequence.
Yes. Think about the various children that aren't going to be able to access things they need to access, or will lose access to social spaces that are accessible to them because of, you know, some of these things.
Yeah. But also, it was so nice that she pointed out that, like, gaming is there to decompress after a long day. Yeah. Like, yesterday, I am trying to get... So, I've been sick for, like, 8 months. I'm finally starting to be better and finally getting over the sickness, getting back into training. So, yesterday, after I've been working out, I had to, like, not do anything, be in my cage of no sensory input other than Tamagotchi life. Because I needed to decompress after my body had to do the strenuous thing of working out again. Gaming is so important, and I absolutely love it. And it was a really wonderful talk that made me cry when I watched their little trailer for the Minecraft world. I highly recommend people checking it out because it was so cool.
Indeed. So yeah, then we get on to day two, which started with Wednesday's Designing for Accessibility by Pierre Corbianis. This is a game we've talked about a little bit before. It is a game that has quite heavy themes in it.
Yeah.
It tackles themes of childhood sexual abuse and incest. The developers wanted to make that story, as heavy as it is, wanted to make it as accessible to as wide an audience as possible. Because I think that like they made a really good point early on with this, we need to talk about these topics if we want to best protect children and vulnerable people from experiencing these things. And if you're going to like have conversations about these topics in ways that protect people from becoming victims of them, those conversations need to be accessible. They pointed out early on people with disabilities are far more likely to be the victims of things like CSA and incest. And as such, like, it is really important that these kind of stories be accessible to the people who are most likely to be victims of these.
Yeah. And I think that one of the coolest accessibility features of this game is that it has like a traffic light system almost, where every chapter of the game, you get told if this chapter is going to include something traumatic. And he said that that was to make sure that people can still laugh because it is a slice of life game still. And
there are times where it's meant to be funny and people weren't laughing because they were too on edge of like, is this about to be a heavy scene?
Yeah, because nobody likes to laugh of a joke and then the next punchline is something that is horrible and then you go, whoa, I am not that horrible of a person. So this, not only is this a really good way of indicating when people need to be in the headspace of wanting to go into the next chapter, but also giving you the point of going like, hey, it's safe now to laugh about this. Is this a safe place to have fun and joke about things again? You can laugh about things and then we will hit you in the face in the next chapter, but that's okay. We will let you know before we do it.
Nice thing that came up in this talk was them talking about ARTE, their publisher, Arte, has a list of 92 accessibility points. They looked through for their game. They were like, well, 24 of them are already in place due to our core design. Some of them aren't applicable. What's the cost to do all the remaining ones? And like, did the maths of like, this from this big starting list, what things can we achieve from this and do as many of them as possible? Every game that publisher does now uses this same process of start from this 92, work out what ones you're already doing, work out what ones we can ignore, work out which ones we'd like to add, prioritize them so you add as many of the remaining ones as budgetable as possible.
Yeah.
Which I think is really cool.
Yeah, and I think it's cool. So he ended by saying that he actually focusing on accessibility saved him a bunch of money because having controller support already added made it so that when he was taking over to Steam Deck, that was already ready to go. And when he, because he had accessibility for vision, he already have large enough text for it to be readable when you played it on your phone. So like, accessibility can just save you money if you implement it early in the game.
They also talked about the benefits of, they consulted with two different consulting companies for accessibility throughout the process. They got Game Accessibility Hub in really like quite early to look at a vertical slice, and then EasySurf, who we do work for, when like the finished game was done, so that they could go, right, even though we have this list of 92 things and we think we're doing a lot, let's put this in front of actual disabled gamers. Oh, here's a bunch of stuff we hadn't even considered that's come up. And then at the end, going, hey, we already did all the things that a group of disabled gamers told us to do. Let's get someone in just to double check that in practice we successfully did what the last group, the first group didn't miss anything, or that we've done everything properly that they recommended. And that second group didn't have to give much feedback at all because they followed the advice well from the first group, etc. But like, that kind of do it early and then do it again later to check you didn't screw up. Great approach.
Yeah. The next talk was actually one of the talks that I enjoyed the most. It was called Player Hearing Safety Accessibility is Closed Cousin. And it was a talk about actually safety around audio. And it talked a bit about like how audio, we as humans does not have not evolved any ways to safeguard us towards high noises. Actually, our body does the completely opposite. It increases when we hear a loud noise. It keeps on like being more attent. And also it gives us dopamine. So we want to trigger that loud noise all the time. And also that safety guidelines for hearing from the World Health Organization actually is really, really close in a Venn diagram to what we have as game accessibility guidelines for audio. And I think it's really cool. One of the things that this whole talk started about was how audio sliders saves hearing, and it talked about esports person, player, gamer, esports player who played CS:GO, and he needed to have the volume so loud to be able to hear the footsteps of the enemies when the enemy come, that whenever a bomb or a grenade or a flashbang went off in the game, that destroyed his hearing a bit and a bit. Even when he was got killed in game and then went up to spectator mode, he still just had the sound loud. But the problem was that since he has done this for so many years, even though it is not especially loud, it was loud enough to give him tinnitus now in later life. So he developed our own little plugin that you can put into the CS:GO to make sure that when you're spectating, the volume just gets reduced, so you save your own hearing. And this is like, it feels really smart to talking about it. It's a safety guideline that we can all should know about. One in five of the age 20 to 29 in the US has some damage to their hearing. These are good tips to take with you, and also understand that your game can actually hurt people. So you should also understand that you have to take precaution. And they talked about direct things you can do to make sure that people playing your game, even if your game has loud sounds, make sure that they don't get hurt by playing your game. And he talked about your YouTube in it. Yeah, that's
Yeah,
cool.
that's always nice when I get jump scared by like, oh, that's me.
And I was quite surprised because they said like 80 decibel, you can hear that for 40 hours a week, and they consider it still to be safe. And for every 3 decibel goes up, the time you can hear it before it's not safe anymore reduced by half. So if you can listen to 80 for 40 hours, you can only listen to 83 for 20 hours.
Yeah, so the thing about the decibel graph, as we generally talk about it, is it's not a linear graph. It's
No.
not like 88 is 10% higher than 80. It's that every 10 decibels you go up, you've doubled in volume. It's an exponential curve. So like it sounds like only a few decibels higher wouldn't be that bad, but it's like no, it very quickly you go over that threshold where it's like you the he used the metaphor of it's like radiation.
Yes, or
X amount of
smoking.
radiation is safe for X amount of time, or smoking, but the more intensity or the more time exposure are both factors that will increase your risk.
Yes, and there was a lot of things here I did not know, and also some things that I sort of had a vibe or a feel that this was what it was, but now got the numbers, and I ended up actually sending this to somebody I know who is a teacher teaching esport to people at high school, and I sent him this to him, and I was just like, "This you should know about this because this is actually really good for you to teach the children that you are teaching to make sure that people can have their hearing for a longer time." It's sort of hearing and eyes. You should be really careful about it. You only have one set of them. If you get a cochlear implant or you get other helping tools, they are not the same. They do not like they do not give you back your hearing. It just helps you. It's not the same. And if you damage your hearing, you are effed because there is no way of getting it back. Once it's damaged, it's damaged forever. And it's important knowledge to know.
Indeed. Then we had a talk called The Shadow Interface and Screen Readers. Again, a really good, like, practical talk for game developers about basically the fact that tools like screen readers, and there are other tools, but I think screen readers is the really easy example to give of this, aren't looking at the pixels on the screen to read them.
No.
There is like an invisible second version of your user interface that screen readers are getting access to. And that needs to be laid out in a really specific way. This is important for things like braille displays, hover text, switch control, eye tracking, Basically, the idea is, let's say you go to a Wikipedia page for something as a person, a sighted person. You don't read every single word on that page to find the information you need. You skim that page looking at headings until you see the heading that's probably correct, and then start listening one para you start reading one paragraph at a time. That one doesn't look right, I'll skip to the next paragraph. You need like a hierarchy tree that you use as a visual person to go find the most likely place the info I need is, then get more specific, then get more specific. Text-to-speech has to work like that. Text-to-speech can't just go read everything on the page in order, as one big chunk of text. You've got to set it up so that people can, like, jump between their tabs, so that, like, if someone's using a switch to go, like, hop me between interactable elements, that it's doing so in a sensible order that makes sense and not just randomly hopping between links. You need to look at. You need to be really aware of this kind of structure when developing things.
Yeah, I think a really good quote from the talk was that screen readers are scanning for structure, not listening linearly. And I think that is really, really well said. I learned a lot of things here, but this is a heavy talk. This is quite a developer heavy talk. But I learned a lot of things, which isn't often that many times now when I've been in this industry so many years. I'm always really, really happy when I learn some new stuff. And I also think it is cool that she talked about how bottlenecks are almost never the user's fault. It is always how hierarchy and structure is made up. So it's important. And
I
also,
think, oh yeah.
I just one last thing. I also think it's actually really cool because she dared to say something that I think a lot of developers sometimes are afraid to say. And that was that she said to us who are like accessibility expert that like, it isn't always as easy as you make it sound like. It isn't just to do these simple steps and then you have an accessible game. Sometimes actually implementing it is hard and it's hardcore and it will take hours and days and months and years to be able to do it. And she talked a bit about how screen readers, yes, they have this similar setup, but if you put it on an iOS or an Android, it will actually be different. And I'm really glad that she's saying this because then this will make me go, okay, next time I talk about blind accessibility, I have to then make sure that I also understand that it has its limits. So maybe it will fit better for somebody who focus on a game that is mobile game only for the ISO or something like this. I think it was really cool of her to be able to dare to say things because a lot of devs don't want to scare away us who are accessibility expert, and she dared to say the words a lot of people don't dare to say.
I do think it's important that there is another thing she said there that I think is an equally important takeaway, which is something like screen reader implementation is only really likely to be one of those big, insurmountable problems if you don't think about it from the start.
Yes.
If you think about it early, it is a very manageable thing to
Yes.
manage. It is only when you haven't thought about it and then you get a chunk of the way in and then you have to try and retrofit it, that's where the problem comes and it becomes a nightmare to do.
Yeah.
So yeah, then we had a panel talk called UI and Accessibility. This involved Patricia Hodgson, who was the UX designer that used to be at Ubisoft, David Moore, who was senior UX engineer at Rare, Elisabetta Andriani, senior UI designer at Ubisoft, and Hannah O'Hare, senior technical UI designer at Rebellion. This is a panel that it was enjoyable to listen to, but I'll be honest, there was not a lot for me to learn from this. There were a couple of interesting things. There was some talk of things like setting up standards up front, so like at the start of your design process, going, we are not going to anywhere in this game use a font smaller than whatever size, and committing to that early on and not letting yourself have exceptions to it. Like going up front, text needs to be at least this size to be legible. Let's never go below that with this game, and like, committing to it. Approaches on things like maintaining what the last game did and iteratively improving on that.
Yeah, this was one of the talks that I actually didn't see this year. Again, like panels can be Sometimes I find panels to be really hard to keep track on, so I often jump over them, and sadly this time as well I had to. It's too much.
That's fair. I think there's like two things I would maybe point out that were good from this talk, and it's not to say the rest of the talk wasn't good, it was just, it was a lot of discussion of very basic things that like were not particularly notable to me.
Nope.
One really good observation was the idea of when you're localizing text, let's say you're a developer that's primarily working in English, and you know that your game's going to be translated into multiple different languages, maybe some that are lengthier to show text in, like Chinese or Japanese, create a fake language in your development tool that basically just doubles the length of words. So you can put your existing English script into it, and it just doubles the length of each of your English words. As a great way to see at a glance if things like line breaks and things are going to work when you localize, and whether your text will still manageably fit inside the boxes you're expecting it to. Doubling the length of your English words is a really like quick, cheap way to go, will most of my localizations fit how I need them to?
Yeah.
And also there was just some good discussion of like the fact that the medical model of disability says you need to find workarounds to your disability. Whereas, you know, things like the social model of disability are take the approach that others need to be making accommodations, like reasonable accommodations for your disability. It's not your job to have to work around them yourself.
Yeah.
Good panel. Nothing huge to learn from it if you're someone that's already kind of invested in this space.
Yeah.
Then we had... Unlocking an Invisible Market, User Needs and Design Logic of BLV, which is Blind Low Vision, Mobile Games in China.
Oh yeah, no, I was just going to say that this one I really enjoyed.
I was just going to say, this is based on the winner for Best Academic Research Paper at the GA Conf Awards this year. And I'm really glad that a kind of hard to access academic paper got boiled down to into an approachable half hour talk.
Yes. And also there was two things that I want to say about this. For the first, it was based on the games market in China. And yes. I am glad that we are starting to talk about it, because the West keeps on only approving things coming from two countries often in Asia, and that is Japan and South Korea. There are so many markets that does a lot of good things in Asia, China in gaming being one of them. And a large country with a lot of investors and huge markets and huge like studios, we need to talk about them. They're a huge untapped market for game accessibility. So I'm glad we're talking more about it and letting people like get their eyes up for this big market in China.
Yeah, I like that they also acknowledged that alongside China, Africa as a region is basically... China and Africa are basically the two places that are seeing massive mobile game growth right now, and that are like really important areas to be looking at what the trends involving are.
Yeah, they assume that 2.4 billion users will be mobile gamers by 2029.
Yeah.
That's insane numbers.
Yeah. And, you know, talking about the market for blind and low vision accessible mobile games, this talk focused on one single mobile game development company that is designing their games to be blind and low vision accessible. This one company and their three games that are currently released have 600,000 daily active players. That is a big market already for games that are being made accessible sort of... fundamentally, they talked about a lot of the challenges that this developer's games face, things like, so one of the games they talked about in specific was this auto battler, and being like, there is lots of information that the player needs to understand at once, and we need to make sure that audio channels aren't overlapping. How do you maximize getting as much information to the player as possible, as quickly as possible, so that you're not talking over yourself in real time as... the player needs this information.
Yep.
They also talked about blind and low vision gamers generally getting really frustrated when developers treat blind players as needing simple experiences. Like, they want to be challenged, they want to be treated the same as other gamers in terms of, like, the complexity of experiences they're being presented. But yeah, very good talk. Really nice to see an academic paper broken down in a good, accessible way.
Yeah, and like I also like that she pointed out how gaming is a huge form of giving community to people, and
Yeah.
also that she like mentioned it a bit, but like how AI again is positive, but it puts like this seems like a lot of stakeholders then thinks that, oh, we have AI now, so now we put the problem back on the players and not the game studio itself. So they go like, oh, but you have AI, so you personally, as a person, as a single gamer, need to fix your own problem rather than the company making games accessible. And again, I'm glad that she pointed that out, which is something that I pointed out in the Discord for the other talk, that that is a scary thing if that is the way we're going due to AI. So
Yeah.
I'm glad she pointed out. And if not, there is like a really short, she has like a, this is the take from the talk at the end. So if you just want to see that, you can just look at the last pictures you have on her slide, and she quickly go through what the finding of their studies got.
Yeah. Then we had accessibility as a product metric. How to advocate for it with business shareholders in mobile games. Again, lots of focus on the mobile market, but I do think that almost everything this talk talks about can apply outside of mobile
Yeah.
gaming. Like, so much of this is really applicable to the wider games industry in terms of selling accessibility to the people who have the money and maybe don't care on a moral level about accessibility, who just want to be convinced numerically that it's important. It talks a lot about, like, mobile in particular is very fast-paced and metrics-driven. The shareholders are like, will often be like, what's our return on investment here? Every feature is competing for time and budget. Trying to find ways to reword the ways you're talking about accessibility to appeal to the people you're trying to get that message across to. Some good examples is like if your shareholders are saying things like, well, our players don't need accessibility, you can point out for mobile games, mobile players are already playing one-handed, often on their commute, playing in noisy places or with no sound, on things like a shaking bus where their inputs might not be accurate, small text might be hard to read, it might be a child or teenager reading with a different reading level and attention span. These are all things that are going to be helpful to disabled people, but already appeal to your core market anyway. That maybe this is a starting point. You know, it's trying to find those kind of ways to pitch accessibility is not a niche thing when you try and sell it to these people.
Yeah, and I think it was really a nice way of putting it when you have a mobile game that is free. It's really important for you to get the player to get to the first ad. That is really, really important for
Yes.
people that play when they play, or for the developers when you have a free mobile game. And she talked a bit about how if your game aren't accessible, the people will drop off before in the tutorial and before they come to the first ad. So they
Yeah.
are actually a zero sum player. And how, like, when you have an accessible game that is easy to understand and all of these other things, then you keep on people to be on the app and you actually make money from it. And like, do I wish that we didn't need to talk this capitalistic about accessibility? Yes, but we live in a
Yeah.
capitalistic world. That is just reality. So I'm glad somebody is talking about it and actually giving us the figures and the numbers and the metric. Because we need to talk about it.
Yeah.
For some people, their job is to think about the metric and numbers, and that is their job, so we need to convince them.
Yeah. This next one I have very few notes on. Partial Spectrum Warrior, talk by David Jenkins about being autistic and having ADHD. I made basically no notes for this because I also am autistic and ADHD, and it's a good talk, but it's also a talk that was very much like I was watching it going, yep.
I talked
Yep.
about I the only two notes or three notes I said was it's fun to see more talks about autism because I myself after the talk last year about autistic burnout, that is what made me go and get checked and then getting my autism diagnosed. It made me feel seen, and because they say a bunch of things that I always experience, and also it just points out yet again why so many of us ends up working in the game industry, because it fills and ticks off so many boxes for us. So yeah, it was a great talk. I smiled through it all. But yeah.
Yeah. And then there's my talk.
Then your talk. That was good, though. I'm glad that you, you might have done it other places as well, but I'm glad to see that you're pointing out the numbers.
This is the first time I've done this talk.
Oh, awesome.
So this was the statistics behind accessibility advertising. And this is basically a 15-minute micro talk that I wedged more than 15 minutes of stuff into as best I could. Talking about the Accessibility Summer Showcase in terms of, like, what are the raw numbers in terms of, like, numbers of people who saw the showcase, how has that trended over the last few years, how does that break down based on, like, the main showcase, BSL, ASL audio descriptions, what kind of impacts did we see in terms of, like, press coverage, what actions were taken to maximize prominent placement in pre-Summer Games Fest advertising, what the numerical impacts were in the first 2 years of Steam giving us some degree of promotion, and then looking at individual games and where applicable and where developers were happy to share, talking about, like, specific games that showed up in the showcase, what impacts did they witness as a result of being in the showcase? So, like, what numbers of wish lists were they getting in, like, a four-day window around the showcase happening? Was it leading to increases in sales? Was it leading to things like... I talked a lot about Periphery Synthetic and, like, the role that the AA Showcase had in that getting press coverage and then sort of awards nominations. And basically trying to give as much numerical data as I am able to give as someone that, like, can't break terms and conditions for certain places that I'm tracking numbers.
Yeah.
And also has to rely on developers to be willing to openly share some stuff. How much numerical data can I give people to go... There is a financial benefit to accessibility advertising. There is a consistent audience coming back year after year looking for accessible game advertising delivered in this way. It is having a tangible impact. Like, this is the percentage of people who watch this showcase who go and wishlist a game on Steam. And trying to package that information up in a way that goes, look, if you can make a little trailer, this is probably the return on making that trailer you will get. If getting another 1,100 wish lists on Steam is worth producing a couple of minute long trailer, consider doing that. That's a measurable thing you might... That is a measurable response you might see to putting in this work to talking about accessibility.
Yeah, I was also surprised when you showcased, like, how much Steam stepped up and Valve stepped up, like, actually helped. And I'm really, really glad for that, because I did not know that.
Yeah, the Steam numbers from year one to year two of being on Steam really jumped up a lot. And I think a lot of it was to do with not just being on Steam as an event, but, like, getting them to place me alongside the other Summer Games Fest events. It made a big difference in terms of, like, the raw numbers of people who aren't accessibility people who still came across the showcase and looked at those games.
Yep.
And trying to bridge that gap of, this is a niche thing I shouldn't pay attention to because I don't need accessibility, to it being a thing people went, well, I'll still look at what games are there.
Yes.
So yeah, we'll see. I might end up doing another version of this talk down the line, depending on how the next couple of years of the showcase go and if there are any particularly interesting insights that come out of it. But it was nice to be able to give some tangible info about, like, hey, if you do, like, a dedicated blitz of accessibility marketing, here are some impacts that might have for you.
It was nice to see. The next talk was the last one that I didn't get to see. I didn't have time.
I could talk about this one quickly. Yeah. Unseen Diplomacy 2, Developing Accessible Room Scale VR. This talked a lot about many of the challenges that this development studio had with making their room scale VR game accessible. Some of the things that got talked about included needing to make sure that their art design was strong enough that it could still be visible and understood at low resolutions, because obviously each eye is seeing a relatively low resolution in a VR headset because it's rendering twice. But also it was important to them, budget-wise, that they wanted to be able to run on the Oculus Quest 2 or the Meta Quest 2, because that is, like, the most affordable entry-level standalone VR headset. It is the popular mass market one. and they wanted to make sure that everything in their design was cleanly legible on the resolution of that budget headset.
Yeah.
They talk a lot about the fact that, like, prescription VR lenses are rare, and needing to account for the fact that someone may not feel comfortable wearing their glasses inside their VR headset, and still needing, like, the overall design to be clear enough in that context. Generally, realistic, photorealistic textures become hard to see in VR. The fact that players can put their head right next to an object can make visual flaws show up really easily, and, like, the sort of design considerations that leads to. Players need to know what the robots in this game are doing. They need to be able to hear robot callouts and what direction they're coming from. That's hard to do if the robots are far away or around corners, things that would dampen the sound of them in a player's ears. But also, if there's multiple bots calling at once, or there's a hard of hearing player, they still need this information about what the robots are doing. That leads into designing things like subtitles that exist in the world, like, that help you identify geographically where a thing is based on where the subtitles showed up. Single-handed controls being really important for a bunch of reasons, not just accessibility ones. And it sort of tied back a lot into Carrie's talk about, like, simplifying your control scheme down as much as you can. And then also getting over the fact that they wanted this to be a room scale experience, and going, that's our intention, but we do still need to make sure that, like, seated play options are available. Find ways to make this game accessible for people who can't, like, duck down to the ground to get underneath the laser wires they're trying to get past. What are your options to work around that?
Yeah.
Good talk. VR accessibility is a really underexplored area of accessibility, and there's a lot of good insights in there. And then we had the last talk.
Yay.
Many cats, many consultants, many Matt moments.
Yes.
Which was a talk given by and about Many Cat Studios, who are a video game accessibility consultancy group who do really wonderful work.
Yes. And it was like their story, and it's so nice that even though Chris's story is more about, like, industry-wise, I see a lot of the same problems and barriers I have had with my content creating thing. And, like, it was just nice. I highly recommend to take a look at it, especially if you are in the industry working for yourself. And, like, because it sort of feels like a feel-good talk, because it is a feel-good talk about, a lot of us are struggling with the same thing, and you're not alone in it. I don't know if that was the idea behind the talk, but that was what I felt. So I think others will also feel it.
Yeah, it's a really good talk. It's a very good sales pitch for the work that Many Cats do. They're doing fantastic work. Go support them.
Yeah.
Hire them for things. And I'm not just saying nice things about them because they sponsored last year's AA Summer Showcase, and they might be sponsoring this year's as well. Regardless, they do all of them there do fantastic work.
They do.
Think this is worth watching, even if just to get a sense of, like, what it is, why it's special what they're doing in terms of their consultancy stuff. They're very impressive.
Yeah.
So there we go. We did it. That's 2 days of GA Com.
Oh my god, 1 hour and 15 minutes. Holy hell.
Oh.
Laura.
Oh, we rattled through. We did it.
We did it. Where can people find you?
People can find me at Laura K Buzz pretty much everywhere on the internet. Patreon, that's the one that pays the bills. If you go to YouTube right now, you can see a couple of episodes of Accessibility I'm really proud of. I did an accessibility review for Saros, which is the new PS5 game from the developers of Returnal from a few years ago. I also have a preview up of 007 First Light, the new James Bond game that's coming out. I went to a preview event for that, played 3.5 hours, and I spent a lot of that time digging around the accessibility and the settings menus. As far as I'm aware, I'm the only person who's talked about the accessibility settings in that game, so go check that video out. What about you, Arevia? Where are you out on the internet?
You can find me all around on the internet under the name Arevia, except TikTok, because somebody stole my name. There I am, Arevia Gaming. And I post twice a week now of short content. And the latest video I think people should check out is that I found some problems with the Xbox Adaptive Joystick and how it has been adapted to be working with a keyboard actually do not work in games, so you cannot actually use it as a keyboard with a mouse in a game, which sort of goes against what this newest update should be, and I really hope that Xbox will fix that. But please do go and watch that and like give a like or just watch it or comment something, because that helps pushing it through to people that can actually do the change with this, because I really wish, I do not think that they know that this is a problem, because if they knew, they would most likely have fixed it.
Yeah. Also, one that I'll very quickly pitch is I am probably next week, I hope, if everything lines up, I should be able to have this as my video for next week. I should be having an accessibility review on AA for the Steam controller, for the new Steam controller. So look forward to that next week.
Yes.
Or by the time you see this, it might already be up. So have a look on YouTube. It might be up by now. I think that's everything we got for this week. Thank you very much, everyone. Goodbye.
Bye.